Ja, men god aften og velkommen alle sammen. Jeg er Tom Gillesberg, formand for Schiller-instituttet i Danmark. Og det her vil være det, jeg siger på dansk. Og det er kun sådan set for at spørge, er der nogen, der ikke forstår engelsk? Så skal de række hånden op. Fordi så laver vi lidt oversættelse til dansk dernede i hjørnet, hvor Steven sidder. Og dem, der gerne vil have oversættelse til dansk, de bedes at samle sig dernede. Resten, det bliver på engelsk. And welcome. I'm Tom Gillesberg, chairman of the Schiller Institute in Denmark. We have a very special guest tonight, as you can see, Helga Seppler-Roos, the international founder and chairwoman of the Schiller Institute. I'll introduce her a little bit later. First, we would like to open with some music, three short pieces by Johann Sebastian Bach. That Michelle Rasmussen will perform, and it should be said she had to jump in on a very short notice because our other pianist missed his play. Thank you. As I said before, it's a very great honor and to have Helga here tonight. She's not in Denmark too often. We might change that in the future. While she has been here, we have been calling around to many institutions to try to arrange for her message to get into to many different Danish institutions. There's actually been a lot of receptivity and a lot of interest in hearing what she has to say. Now, for those who don't know Helga, she has a very long, very unique political career behind her. For over 30 years now, she's also been married to Lyndon LaRouche, and thereby been Lyndon LaRouche's closest collaborator. She, in her own right, is a scholar of Friedrich Schiller, Nicholas von Kusa, and also in general much in German history. She was one of the founders of the European Labour Committees, and the founder and chairwoman of the Europäische Arbeiterpartei in Germany, ran as a chancellor candidate, upset the political elites in Germany for many years. In 1982, she founded Club of Life, and in 1984, she then was the initiator of founding the Schiller Institute as a European-American alliance to rebuild the planet, you could say. Now, at the same time, she has also been very active as a political leader in German political life, trying to inspire the otherwise not so visionary political leadership of Germany. In 1992, she then was also the key initiator in founding BÜSO, Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität, where she has to the present day been the chairwoman and been participating in every election that she can get her hands on. Now at the same time, she has also then been at a very difficult time when Lyndon LaRouche actually was put into jail and for 5 years were in jail in the United States. Helga also was fighting extremely hard to get her husband out of jail. But meanwhile, she also became a very active force at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall in actually doing what the German government had no clue in what she's doing, that was to reorganize Europe after this great opportunity came. And she therefore was very actively engaged in putting together a proposed policy for the reunified Germany, for something called the productive triangle, for how we could build up all of Europe to be a locomotive for the world economy. She was a very key person in putting together the Eurasian land bridge, extending this European collaboration across Eurasia. In China, she became known as the Silk Road Lady for her many visits to China, where she was fighting very, very hard for building the Eurasian land bridge. And also has been a quite often been a guest in both China, in India, in Russia, many times also with Lyndon LaRouche, sometimes on her own. Setting up basically the basis for a rebuilding of the whole planet. And very explicitly in opposition to the attempts after 9/11 in the United States and the attempts of creating a clash of civilization, she has been a very key voice in instead very concretely having a dialogue of civilizations between the European civilizations, China, Russia, India, other major cultures and powers of the world. And then she has also, in February 1997, she initiated a first of a long series of calls for a new Bretton Woods financial system, where she's been trying to rally political leaders and economists, others, active citizens of any walk of life to actually fight for having a new financial system. And where many thought that, oh, she must be exaggerating, we have such a nice system, everything is fine. But by now it's clear to everybody that she was not exaggerating the least, and now the time has come to actually implement many of these ideas that she and Linda LaRouche has been putting forth. Now, if I was to list all of the initiatives she has been involved in or launched, then she wouldn't get to speak, so I won't do that. I'll just say it's a great honor and privilege to have you here, and please welcome.
Well, thank you for these kind words. I'm actually very happy to be here. And I hope that you will, as I go through the description of the world picture, that you will not get too upset. But I have to tell you that the world is in a very big crisis. And only from being here for a couple of hours, I naturally don't imagine that I know what the Danish people are thinking, but I recognize today from the few encounters I had a phenomena which I know from the past, and that is that the Danish people have one world champion in the polls to be the most happy people, but that has also a little bit the idea that the crisis may happen elsewhere, but it will not really come to Denmark. Not in the same way. Now, I unfortunately have to start my remarks with saying that we are right now in a breakdown crisis of the whole world financial economic system, but not only that, we are in a crisis of culture, of morality, of everything you have believed in would be normal to our society. We are right now literally at the end of an epoch. It's very difficult to identify exactly when this epoch started, but a good way of making such a point would be probably the beginning of the, or the middle of the 15th century. When the period of the Dark Age, of the collapse of the Roman Empire, and the following mixed periods, and then the plunge in the Dark Age of the 14th century came to an end, and you had with a whole bunch of developments the evolution of the modern nation state in France for the first time under Louis XI, with the writings of Nicolaus of Cusa, establishing for the first time modern natural science and the modern nation state, and with the Golden Renaissance in Italy, a period which was characterized for the last 600 years by a continuous fight between a sovereign nation state and a state defined for the common good of the people on the one side, and various oligarchical systems, empires on the other side, trying to eliminate the nation state. And these 600 years, where you had basically sometimes the one tendency being on top, the other time the other tendency being on top, I would offer the hypothesis that this period, this epoch of 600 years, where you had the struggle between these two totally opposite positions, is coming to an end. The question now is, what will be the new epoch? Will the new epoch be a collapse of civilization, or can we in time make the kinds of reforms which can avoid that catastrophe. Now, I will come back to this question, but let me just tell you, whatever you are reading in the newspapers, what you hear in the media, in the TV, or other places, it's all false. Because the main line I heard from the economic minister here is that the crisis will be over by August. We have a very young, and I would say talented for the future, economic minister ourselves, which means he has to still unfold his potential because it has not been materializing yet, who has predicted that the crisis will be over conveniently end of this year, that is after the German federal election, so people should vote and then afterwards the crisis will be over. Now, the question you should ask yourself is, who of these politicians or any other journalists or economists told you in 2005, 2006, 2007 that such a crisis would occur? I don't think you can name anyone except Lyndon LaRouche and this movement, because everybody else told you, oh, there will be no crisis at all, everything will be fine. And then when the crisis finally erupted, everybody said, oh, nobody could foresee this crisis. We were completely surprised. So therefore, you should ask yourself the question, if these people could not make a correct prognosis, then why should they make a correct prognosis now? Because they have not changed. They have not changed the legislation. They have not done any of the things which would be necessary to remedy the situation. Now, since this crisis erupted in the beginning of October 2007, actually 3 days after Mr. LaRouche made the famous webcast on the 25th of July, that the system had gone already, that the system had collapsed already, and that everything we would see from now on would be the different aspects coming to the surface. 3 days later, after he made that webcast, which if you have not seen it in the internet yet, please go and look at the archive of this historical webcast, and you will be surprised with what clarity and power Mr. LaRouche was able to say what the condition actually was. Now, well, ever since this happened, approximately, nobody knows exactly, but approximately almost $50 trillion were pumped into the system. Approximately $25 trillion were pumped in the US banking system, much of it officially, but a lot of it also secretly under the over the counter, just to try to bail out the system. And in Europe, it was similar, the same in Asia. So, well, despite the fact that the amazing sum of anywhere between $40 and $50 trillion, were put into the banking system, this had had no effect. As a matter of fact, if you look at the effect on the real economy worldwide right now, you have an economy in a free fall. I just give you some figures which I could make a long list of. The Japanese export in February collapsed on a yearly basis by 50%. Now 50%, that is half, that is almost, it's half. Industrial production in Germany in February on a yearly basis collapsed 23.7%. Now that is almost a quarter of the German industry which collapsed. Similar figures you have in China, where steel production collapsed by 60%. You had a total collapse of the German exports, and so forth and so on. And this is just the beginning, and this will not be stopped. This is going to continue, and it will get worse and worse and worse. Now, you had basically a situation where at the recent G20 summit in London, almost a month ago, you had the 20 most powerful nations of the world making a decision that they would pump another $6 trillion into the system, $5 trillion through contributions from the different states, another $1 trillion to beef up the International Monetary Fund with so-called special drawing rights. And in the meantime, there is a public acknowledgement by the governments that they have not only lowered the interest rate to almost zero in the United States, to almost zero in Great Britain, the European Central Bank to 1%, but that they have now added to that openly money printing. The British government has told the Bank of England that they should print £150 billion sterling, and they call this in nice Orwellian doublespeak quantitative easing, which is just another word for printing money. They have said to the IMF that the IMF should have $250 billion worth of special drawing rights, and they call that quantitative easing on an international scale, which means they have given the IMF the power to print money as they need it. Now, if you think that that will help anything, I can assure you not, because, I mean, look, the consequence of this in Eastern Europe, for example, the Baltic states, Poland, Czechia, Romania, Hungary, all of these countries are in a complete free fall. They need enormous amounts of money, mainly from the West, and given the fact that right now, because of the Eurozone, Germany, Holland and Finland are the only countries which still have a surplus, but Germany is the largest economy, it basically means that Germany is supposed to pay for the failing East European banks, which are really investments by Swiss banks, by Austrian banks and so forth. Now, the Eurozone is about to disintegrate because you have countries which have an enormous indebtedness, like Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain, and they have to pay almost 2.5% more interest for new credits than, let's say, Germany, and therefore the tensions within the Eurozone are becoming such that there is now, 10 years after the Euro existed, an open debate that the Eurozone may not last very long, because some countries cannot afford to stay within the Euro because they have to pay such high interest rates for any new money. So this will get worse, and obviously when you have the two processes of deflation and inflation, what will happen? There is now in the financial media a big debate. Are we having deflation or are we having inflation? And this is a completely ridiculous debate because we have both. We have deflation. Deflation means that the prices are shrinking, collapsing, because there is a lack of demand, because people have no money and they have fear of the future and therefore they don't buy. Therefore, if people don't buy, the prices are going down even more. So that means that production is getting less. You have a real depression. We are already fully in a depression. But if you think that that is now a reason why all this money should be pumped to restart the economy, as they are saying, this is complete bullshit, because they're not restarting the economy. They're trying to save the banking system. And what happens if you have a collapse of the real economy and at the same time you have this enormous amount of liquidity building up? The biggest danger, what is now about to happen, is that you have an economy which is falling flat globally, worldwide, while at the same time this hyperinflationary bubble is building up, and this can unload very, very quickly And then you have hyperinflation in a very short period of time. Now, I don't know if people in Denmark know about 1923. I'm German, so I, you know, my grandparents and my aunts, they were all telling me about it, and I still have these notes, you know, 1 trillion, 1 billion, you know, this is what happened after the First World War. Germany had an enormous amount of debt from the own cost for the war, and they had to pay, according to the Versailles Treaty, the war reparations. Now, you know, so what the German Reichsmark did in order to pay all of this money, which was much beyond the capability of the German economy to produce real goods, they just printed it. You know, they printed it and paid and printed. And for a long time, this nobody noticed, because for 3 years, you know, it went fine. When did it go wrong? When the French occupied the Rhineland in 1923, and then the German workforce, in protest to that, went on a strike. So the German economy, especially in the Ruhr, came to a grinding halt, and then you had the explosion of hyperinflation from about May to November. It went up from one Reichsmark for a pound of bread to 10, to 100, to a million, to a billion, to a trillion, and then sometimes in November it stopped because people were literally running with wheelbarrows full of notes to the baker, because half an hour later it would be already more expensive. And in the very end, they only printed the bill on one side because they didn't bother to even print the second side. And then it came to a halt, and then Germany was you know, reorganized from the outside through the Dawes plan. But the problem is, this is about what could happen internationally now, you know, but not limited in one country, but, you know, basically according, you know, on a global scale. So, you know, this is what they are playing with, and why do they play with it? Because, well, how did it come to this crisis? And the reason why I'm saying that none of the reforms and none of the actions of the government right now have really addressed the crucial problem is because, you know, what they are trying to do now is just to save the banking system, you know, to save the investors by paying them essentially 100% on their investments. Now, I mean, this is totally insane. Let me take it a step back. Because all of this money, which they are trying to save now, it's approximately 1.4 quadrillion dollars of toxic waste sitting in the banks. Now, 1.4 quadrillion, this is a one, and then 16 numbers behind it. And that is a figure, you know, which has been named by Jacques Attali, who was the former economic advisor of Jacques Mitterrand, and it was published in the French newspaper Marianne. I don't know if it's exactly that figure, but it's in that vicinity. Now, this is paper which, if the banks would sell on the open market, they would get anywhere between 1 cent for the euro, 5 cents, 10 cents for the euro. You know, in other words, they would not find any buyers, or maybe nobody at all, and then they would have to write down that amount of money. And then it would turn out that these banks are bankrupt, so therefore they're all pretending, you know, everything is fine, we have all these assets, but, you know, we need more liquidity, because what happened is that after this crisis was supposedly triggered through the American subprime crisis, you know, all the banks basically stopped to give credit to each other. The so-called interbank lending stopped completely, because every bank knew that they were sitting on enormous amounts of toxic waste, and therefore they knew the other bank was sitting on toxic waste, and therefore they stopped lending among each other and even lending to the industry. And all this money pumping, you know, all this approximately $50 trillion which they pumped did not change that condition. It did not improve the condition of the banks, and it did not improve the condition of the real economy, which is continuous to fall. Now, if they keep this up very, very shortly, in a matter of weeks, mostly months, this hyperinflation will unload, and you will have an economic breakdown of dimensions people have no idea. I mean, if even the Financial Times, Germany, which is, you know, the voice of the city of London, is saying this is the worst crisis in the history of mankind, thereby admitting that it is already beyond the Great Depression of the 30s, that is a reflection of what these people know. So now, if this is not stopped, what you will have is a collapse of the economy. The auto sector worldwide will shrink into maybe 5 or 6 auto producers. You will have all the suppliers, all the steel, all the other producers collapsing. And you will have a downturn of the economy, which immediately means a reduction of the world population. Because what most people nowadays have forgotten is that there is a direct relationship between the industrial capacity and the number of people which can be maintained. So if you shrink the world economy by 20%, you de facto shrink the world population by 20% or even more. I would say even more, because, you know, when you lower the living standard of the population for a very long time, and that is what has happened with the present system of globalization, with all this cheap labor production, with all of this, free trade, then you lower the immune system of the population as well. And you can see right now, in the case of the swine flu pandemic, which is hopefully starting, and hopefully it can be contained, but it is a sign of the time. Because why did it start in Mexico? Because in Mexico, you have more than 50% unemployment, you have a collapse of the living standard, which is horrendous. The whole country is taken over by the narco terrorists who are really controlling the whole country. Mexico, the beautiful, hopeful, emerging country Mexico, has been recently classified by the Supreme Command of the United States as one of the failed states, together with Pakistan. Now, that is the sign of the time of collapsing countries around the world. Now, if this is not stopped, then in a very short period of time, unpredictable developments will take place, a plunge into chaos, hyperinflationary wipeout of the savings of the little people, and you will have a collapse of civilization maybe 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion or more people going to die. If we do not change the world in the next period very quickly, what will happen is basically a dark age. And I have no difficulty to imagine how a dark age would look like, because already now the so-called third world is affected the worst. If you look at the Horn of Africa, Somalia, there is no government anymore. You have pirates, you have bandits, you have gangs. Look at Pakistan, which is in a similar condition of being a failed state. And, you know, narco-terrorism from Afghanistan, from Latin America, is spreading. And I think that people have not enough imagination to really think this through. So therefore, what we are proposing is the only way how this can be done. What we need is a new system. We need a new financial system which basically wipes out this 1.4 quadrillion or a portion thereof of these derivatives, this toxic waste, and we need a new system. We have to have an emergency government of governments who have to declare that this present system is bankrupt, and that basically this toxic waste is taken out of the books. You need to have most of the debt of the world being written off, because it cannot be maintained. Then you need to earmark what is necessary and good in the present system, like pensions, savings of little people, wages, loans to middle-level industries. You have to earmark that so that that will be valid in the new system. Then you have to go back to fixed exchange rates. You have to have a new national banking system, and there has to be government-generated new credits to rekindle the production for things of the common good. If that is done, then, you know, still we have a lot of problems, but you could basically restart the economic recovery right now. So how can that be done? Will it come from the Danish government? Well, I don't want to make a final judgment since I only arrived here today, but it doesn't look to me that the Danish are right now in the right spirit. Will it come from Brussels? Well, I would say Brussels will probably be the biggest opponent of any such policy, because they are married to the neoliberal paradigm, and they are fully for free trade. They don't want to change one bit. Will it come from Germany? No, because Germany takes orders from Brussels. And as long as that is the case, there is no hope from Germany as well. So my husband for a very long time has said that the only way how you can solve this problem is if the four largest and most powerful nations of the world act together to put a new system on the agenda. And he has said that has to be the United States, Russia, China, and India, who have to be a core group, and then other sovereign nations can attach themselves to it, like Denmark, like Germany, like others. But unfortunately, this is a very difficult thing. Now, the reason why only this combination could do it is because the real fight is against the British Empire. Now, I don't mean only the City of London, even if the City of London is the nominal headquarter of that empire. What I mean by British Empire is that system of financial oligarchy who run the hedge funds, who run the private equity funds, who run the big banks, who are the real power behind this present system. Now, they basically want, they don't care. They even, you know, say it doesn't matter if we pour now billions of pounds and sterling and dollars and euro into the system, because we will remain the empire even after the collapse, because we own the raw materials in Africa, we control the oil in the Arab world, so we will be fine for the period after the system. And they are the main obstacle in this. The problem is that the United States, or the positive thing is that the United States has in its tradition the remedy for this in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Because Roosevelt in 1933, when he declared the New Deal, made a demonstration how it is possible to get a country out of a depression by simply giving government credits to everybody who wants to produce something useful, and you know, he led America successfully out of the depression. Roosevelt also, in the famous Bretton Woods Conference of 1944, wanted to end colonialism forever by basically establishing a new system in which third world countries would have the chance for real development as an equal partner. The big problem was that Roosevelt died in April 45, and Truman was a full Anglophile politician who gave the control to organize the post-war period to Churchill. And so the Bretton Woods, which actually was established, was a very mixed bag. It had some positive things like fixed exchange rates, but it perpetuated colonialism and imperialism towards the Third World. Now, you remember that Obama, who is much, was or is much admired by everybody in the whole world, made his election campaign by saying, we will change, we can make it, we can do it. And he said he would be a president in the tradition of Lincoln, in the tradition of Roosevelt. Now, has he done that? It's more than 100 days, and I have not seen any Lincoln or Roosevelt's action from Obama. Now, for those of you who don't know, I should tell you that we did originally not support Obama in the campaign because we supported Hillary Clinton, because we thought that Hillary was a much better economist who did address the fate of the invisible Americans, you know, not the forgotten America, but she spoke about the invisible Americans. And we hoped that she would be the next president because we saw this great worry that Obama got financed by George Soros, by a lot of hedge funds, and you know, we were very skeptical. But then, you know, to make a long story short, when Obama was finally elected, my husband said he is facing the biggest crisis in modern history, and therefore we have to do everything to help him so that the world has a chance. Now, the initial signs were looking quite good because he did not appoint a lot of Soros people, so that even in the New York Post there was an article saying that Soros was very unhappy that his people were not appointed, and instead a lot of Hillary became foreign secretary, a lot of Clinton people were put in the administration, so it looked quite promising. But then it is very clear that Wall Street came back with a vengeance, and they imposed Larry Summers as the main economic advisor of Obama, and they squeezed out a lot of the other 30 economic advisors like Paul Volcker, like Paul Krugman, and some of the other people. And what appeared now was that the Obama policy all of a sudden was controlled by something very strange, something called behavioral economist. Now, if you think that that is some dog trainer who wants to get a more cheap food for his dog by teaching him Pavlovian tricks, no, then you are totally mistaken. What they mean by that is they mix, it has nothing to do with economy, at least not with the real economy, but they mix statistical methods which are unfit to describe economic processes in any case, with neurologists of a special kind. Now you have this strange breed of neurologists who claim that there is no free will, because you can make an MRI or some other test of the brain, and you can recognize electric and chemical processes in the brain before the person makes the decision. And therefore they say, since these chemical processes in the brain exist before you even decide I will go out of the door, it's not you who decides, but it's these chemical genes and other influences, you know, which cause you to do that. Now that's obviously totally insane. It's a total refutation of everything which is European culture and tradition in a positive sense. And it basically, you know, reduces man to a robot or to an animal of some sort. So what they do now is they basically say, you know, the neoliberal paradigm is finished. The free market system is finished. And that was based on an image of man that everything was rational. Because you could be absolutely sure that the individual greed of the people, the greed for money, the greed for wealth, would always be dominant, and therefore it was rational, you could count on it, and therefore, you know, this was a good system. Now, these behaviorist economists say, no, this is wrong, man is not rational because there are other factors which play a role. Now, I looked at some of the writings of these people, and it is quite amazing. They say, for example, that if you, they make tests, you know, if you give a person or two persons, you offer 100 euro. One person has the right to make the offer to the second person and offer him a percentage of how much of these 100 euro he gets if he agrees to the deal. Now, they say that if the first one proposes less than 40% to the second one, the likelihood is that the second one will say, I don't accept that because I want my 50% or else you get nothing. And they both get nothing in the end because the envy of the second one prevents him from even getting 30 or 40%. Now, this is obviously a complete insane image of men, but they say based on these maybe we can turn this off because I have to yell across the you have to you have these people who have not only greed but they have envy, competition and all of these things. Now the job of the economists is to manipulate that and get people to accept reduction of money, to get austerity, to get the trade unions to accept wage reductions and so forth. Now these people right now have the control of Obama. And my husband has said already in the last webcast on the 11th of April that if Obama is not freed of that control from Wall Street, then there is no hope for the human race, and that therefore he has called for the kicking out of Larry Summers and all of these behavioral economists and appoint back or bring back to function the people in the cabinet who are actually qualified, some qualified people among them. Now, tonight, just as we're speaking here, my husband is making a second webcast, which you should all watch at the earliest possible time, where he will basically talk about the same things I'm talking now about, and he will escalate the pressure, because, you see, it's not that Obama has endless time. He has a very short window of opportunity to win this fight, or else he will become as hated as George Bush. It's already beginning because, you know, he had 78% popularity when he came in. He has now 35%. So the popularity of Obama already collapsed from a very high level to a very low level because why? People saw the unemployment is getting worse. Alone in the last month, 900,000 jobs got lost in 1 month. You have now 5 million or more unemployed, people becoming homeless. They are living now in the so-called Obama cities. These are tent cities in the suburbs because people who are being thrown out of their houses, they cannot allow, afford another apartment. They live in their car, they live in their in a tent, and the only reason why you don't see long queues in front of soup kitchens is because the communes do not have the money to buy the soup. Because the states are going bankrupt, California just went bankrupt with 42 billion dollars. So there is a tremendous crisis. People are very angry that, for example, the insurance company AIG got bailed out with 180 billion taxpayer money, and then that money went to bail out foreign banks. You know, so the American taxpayer should pay for the losses of foreign banks. So people get mad, you know, and therefore the rage is building up, and it's a big danger, you know, that the right wing, the right wing Republicans, Rush Limbaugh, Newt Gingrich, such people, they are making, you know, campaigns that they will do everything that Obama fails. Then you have the militias building up you know, weapons. They buy weapons. People buy weapons who never had weapons before, because everybody expects that Obama may change the weapon law, and therefore they all buy now. So you have an explosive social crisis which could easily become a civil war under these conditions. And that is not only true for the United States, but you know, if you look what happened in the Baltic countries, you had mass demonstrations and riots in Greece for weeks. You had people demonstrating against the government, which was triggered by the death of the student. But then, you know, the general rage of the population against the government was really the fuel for this. In France, you already had a demonstration of 3 million people in the streets. And generally, you know, governments know that if a demonstration is larger than 1 million, you cannot use the army or the police, because, you know, you have too many relatives in the army, you have too many, you know, it just does not function. You cannot shoot on 1 million people. So therefore, when I'm saying that if this thing is not changed quickly, there is a danger of a collapse into chaos, I think you better think it really through, because, you know, we have to get the measures proposed by Mr. LaRouche through, or else we are looking into hell, and that straight. So what we propose is to free Obama, and we are doing not badly right now, because we are in a big campaign to mobilize the mayors, the city councils, to go with the legislation proposed by Mr. LaRouche, the so-called Homeowners and Banking Protection Act, which is the idea that the government should tell the people to stay in their apartments and their homes, and then, you know, you fix a rent they can pay, and then you reorganize, you write off all this toxic waste, you save the public banks, you put a new national bank in, and you restart the economy. It is feasible, it is easy, but you have to conquer the power of the financial oligarchy. Now, Mr. LaRouche has also said you need the United States to take the lead, then Russia, China, and India have to work together. Now, Russia is right now in a complicated situation, because on the one side, Putin and Medvedev have done a couple of useful things, but you still have the oligarchy in power in the form of Kudrin, the finance minister. But, you know, if the United States would offer Russia a cooperation in this way, they would do it, I know that. If the United States and Russia would work together, then China would immediately work with them, because, you know, China is in an existential crisis. They have a 2 trillion foreign exchange, out of which more than 1 trillion is in dollar-denominated notes. If the dollar goes down, the Chinese worked for nothing, because all their foreign exchange goes out of the window. They're already losing their export market to the United States and to the European Union right now. So China would go with such a combination. And Mr. LaRouche and I were just in December in India, and everybody we talked to said if the U.S., Russia and China work together, then India will follow immediately. So it is possible, but, you know, it really requires a change, not only of the financial system in the way I described it, but it really requires a change of the axioms which led to this crisis. Now, how did Mr. LaRouche, how was he able to predict this crisis as the only economist worldwide? Sure, you have now other economists who say they also made prognoses, but we have looked at all of them when it happened, and for a very long time, Mr. LaRouche was the only economist who said this system is going to go through a disintegration in the systemic crisis, and none of the others said that. I mean, we followed it very closely over 35 to 40 years. Now, we have to look at the changes which led to this crisis. And, you know, from one discussion we had today with an expert politician, they have no clue. They have no clue. They believe the economic institutes, which are now saying the crisis will be over by 2010. Then when you ask them, yeah, but why should you believe somebody who did not predict the crisis before it came, who have not made an analysis of why it happened, and who are now like reading tea leaves or coffee or looking in a crystal ball, or I don't know what they do, but they miraculously come and say the crisis will be over by 2010. Now, if you do not address the reasons why this crisis occurred, you will not remedy it. So, you know, when in this discussion, which could have been in Germany as well, this person said, yeah, but, you know, we have to bail out the banks because, you know, that is systemic, but we do not have to bail out the industry because a firm which goes bankrupt, they should just go bankrupt. I said, no, the opposite is true. It is much more work to build up high qualified jobs, you know, engineers, skilled workers, you know, to have a functioning machine tool design team working together over decades. That is systemic and not the banks. Now, obviously, you know, this person said, it's just the managers, you know. Well, but the problem is you have in the industry, you do not have entrepreneurs anymore. You have managers. I mean, the paradigm shift which went into the collapse of this system, you really have to take it back. I mean, Mr. LaRouche says to the day Roosevelt died in April 45, because Truman already on that day started to undo a sound economic policy and to go in the neoliberal colonial imperial direction. But then other absolutely crucial changes were, for example, in the 50s and the 60s, in Germany you can see it maybe the most clearest because of the reconstruction after the Second World War, you had an economic caste, middle-level entrepreneurs, who would believe in basic values, in industriousness, in work, in honest work, in the common goods, that they should take care of the common good of the community. They would take out of the firm only so much profit as they needed for their own family, and the rest would be reinvested to be, you know, the next technology, to be competitive. Now, that all changed, as you know, and since the 60s, step by step, you had a replacement of these values with something called money. Money makes money. Somebody who makes honest work is an idiot. He should go to the stock exchange. He should speculate. He should make a lot of money and not, you know, have honest work. Then in 71, when the dollar was decoupled from the gold standard and the fixed exchange rate system was abandoned, this was the beginning of the bubble with the creation of the offshore markets. Oh, that's good. No, because I was getting hoarse. where basically private bankers could go to the Cayman Island or some other offshore markets and make money. Scheckbetrügerei, it's called. You know, you can make out of $100, you make $1,000 by the evening, and, you know, there was no control. Then you had basically all the different steps in the 70s, the increase of the conditionalities of the IMF against the Third World. You had the Reaganomics, Thatcher economics, in the 80s, but then all of this went already in the wrong direction. But the real disaster started in 87, when already the crash of 87 meant that there was a crisis like 29, but then Alan Greenspan became the chief of the Federal Reserve, and he will go down in history as Mr. Bubble of all times. Because at a point when the system was already going through a crash like 29, he started to invent these creative financial instruments, derivatives credit, which essentially was that you could bet on a loss, and then you make another bet on that, and another bet on that, and a bet on that. And then, you know, they resold all of these debt as assets. You know, you have a mortgage, then you sell the mortgage as an asset. And you put it together with other things in packages, you resell it, you speculate on that, you speculate that this goes up, you speculate that it goes down. Short selling, structured investment vehicles, all of this stuff, you know, an unbelievable amount of swindle, really. You know, if you look at what this Madoff, the former head of Nasdaq, did, he swindled his clients out of $50 billion with a so-called Ponzi scheme. And you know what Ponzi did? He was a swindler in the 20s in Boston who realized that after the First World War, a return letter, post stamp, cost 1 cent in Spain and 6 cents in the United States. So he got a couple of people together and said, look, if you invest in this, I promise you two-digit returns. So a lot of people invested, and he paid them enormous profits. After 3 months, they could get 50% profit. And then this spread, everybody said, oh, this is a fantastic investment. So they all went there, and it became so big. Nobody looked at it and said, how many letters are reasonable to be had? You know, they would have to have billions of letters to cover all of this. And actually, this continued until he would always take the new investment money to pay the profit to the first investor. And this went well until it broke and he could not pay one guy, and then the whole thing disintegrated. And this guy Madoff, the former boss of Nasdaq, the technology exchange, you know, he swindled his clients of $50 billion. Then Sir Stanford, another one in Antigua, $12 billion. And so I'm making the point that the whole system is based on this idea. You know, you build a bubble and you profit off the bubble until the bubble collapses. And, you know, this happened with the new market, with the IT bubble, which collapsed in March 2000 with $16 trillion wiped out. So then they needed a new bubble, and they lowered the interest rate of the subprime market to zero, practically. They gave people who had no money and no wages mortgages at a interest rate of 0%. Now, even a child can imagine that this interest rate will not stay at zero forever, especially if you sell that mortgage in the meantime, you know, as an asset packaged with other things, and it becomes a speculative object. Naturally, this had to collapse. And the people who invented it did it, in my view, with criminal intent. You know, just to loot, fill their pockets, and have a lot of people being the losers in the side. Now, we have to go into all of these things and make close these loopholes. This is why my husband has called for a PECORA commission. PECORA was the state attorney who, in the beginning of the 30s, investigated what went into the crash of 29. You know, he found insider trading, thieves, the same thing like today. And then Roosevelt used his findings to make the legislation which made this impossible, like the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking from commercial banking, which was only eliminated in 1999. Now, this has to occur, and, you know, we have to have a completely different paradigm. If anybody thinks we get out of this crisis by just fixing a couple of rules, making a little bit transparency, making the life for the hedge funds a little bit more difficult, forget it. If we do not change fundamentally everything which went with this paradigm of globalization, the world is not going to make it for a very long time. Because we need to completely correct the errors about the image of men. We have to have a completely different attitude about the developing countries. We have to have an end of colonialism for sure and forever. And we have to have cultural and moral values which are worthy of the dignity of man. Because if you look at the present system, do you think it is reasonable that a couple of thousand people are billionaires? You have by now millions of millionaires, but you have 3/4 of the human race who are not making it. I mean, I don't think that that is a system which can be maintained. And we have to have a complete change where the idea of money is being completely, you know, rejected. In a certain sense, I think we need to get away from the idea of money as a value. We have to have a system where every child and every student and every family has enough money that they can live, that they can have an apartment or a house, that they can eat well, that they have a good education, they have access to theater, culture, opera. But beyond that, you don't need anything. You do not need to travel 7 times vacation every year. You don't need to have bridge vacations, you know. Now we have the 1st of May, there is one day in between, so let's have a bridge vacation and let's go to the Bahamas 8-9 times a year. That's insane. You do not need to have endless amounts of money. It doesn't do you any good. Do you want to die and then on your gravestone they have a sign, he ate 5 tons of caviar? First of all, I don't think you would enjoy 5 tons of caviar, but, you know, or some equivalent. No, I think we need a complete change. We need a renaissance where the image of man is being put back in the center of politics, of the economy, of everything. And we have to have an image of man, that man is essentially good, that he is essentially limitless, perfectible, that man, in contrast to all other living beings, is capable of cognitive powers, that man can discover the laws of the universe ever deeper and more basically, and when you do that, you call it scientific progress. And when you apply that scientific progress in the economy, it leads to an increase of productivity and it increases the living standard, the lifespan of the population. And people should find their creativity in contributing to the advancement of mankind. And we have to have a new world economic order where, you know, the principles of the Peace of Westphalia are being applied. Where I believe this is coming from Nicolaus of Cusa, who already in the 15th century said that peace in the universe, peace in the on the planet, concordance is only possible if all microcosms develop in the best possible way, and that an order in the macrocosm depends on the development of the microcosms, and that each microcosm has to take it as his self-interest that the other one is developing in the best possible way. Now, if you apply that to nations, it should be the interest of Denmark that Germany develops in the best possible way, and you should not have grievances over German bad things done in the past to Denmark, but you should be happy that Germany prospers, and Germany should be happy that Denmark prospers. It should be like in a family, you know, where the father is happy that the daughter learns new things, the son is happy that the grandmother learns new things, and, you know, that you are happy if the gifts of the other one are becoming more. You know, and I think this is a completely different idea of foreign policy which is required. Now, obviously, the immediate task is to save Africa. I'm saying that since a long time. If we in Europe cannot save the continent of Africa, we are not going to make it ourselves. And not so much because Africa has nuclear weapons and is threatening us with, you know, such things, but the moral failure to develop Africa and undo the injustice which has been done through many hundreds of years of slave trade, of colonialism, of exploitation. We have a moral obligation to help this continent to, you know, overcome this. and let the Africans do what they want to do themselves, but just give them the necessary material support that they can make the jump. It would be very, very easy. I mean, look, we had at our conference in Rüsselsheim a presentation by a young woman from Zimbabwe. And she very courageously said, look, I want the following railways, I want the following maglev trains to go from north to south, from east to west. I want to build new nuclear powers, reactors, inherently safe, high temperature reactors for large quantity of desalinization of ocean water, of irrigation. I want food processing. I want new cities. And she made a map, you know, where people saw that the infrastructure of Africa in a couple of years should look like the infrastructure of Europe. No, because Europe is only developed because it has a very tight grid of infrastructure. The new bridge, which was built here from Denmark, that is a normal thing, which we need in many places in Africa as well. So it is not very difficult to imagine how to reconstruct the world. The Eurasian land bridge, you know, is more urgent today than ever before. Why should we not, after we have gotten rid of this toxic waste, after we have reorganized the banks, saved some, let go under some others, you know, saved the public banks, the banks which should give credit to the industry, these banks should be saved. The speculative banks should not be saved. Or they should reform and become useful banks. You know, we must make a new test for bankers. Do they know physical economy? Then they can stay banker. If they don't know it, they should become some, they should cut stones in a Steinbruch, in a whatever, or do some other useful work. No, and I think then we could really integrate Eurasia. We could make corridors, development corridors from Japan with a tunnel to Korea. Then we build the Bering Strait tunnel from Alaska to Siberia or to the far east of Russia. Then we have the old Siberian corridor, railway as a corridor, the old Silk Road. It would be very easy to reconnect the world with 20, 30, 40, 50-year contracts where we have a multi-level system of, you know, treaties among sovereign nations. We do not expect them to pay back the initial credit until they have the buying power. You know, we should have contracts of 20, 50 years. You know, and if a country has developed, then, you know, they can pay back a credit they got 30 years earlier. But we should not demand the paying back now. And we should treat this planet. There's so much talk about saving the planet. You know, it's quite insane. Conferences here in Copenhagen, you know, they should have a global cooling conference, because that's actually what's happening right now. There was never a melting of the ice cap, and you have an increase of glacialization right now, and you have a growing community of scientists who say that the reasons for the change of climate, which is changing, lie in the cycles of the sun in relationship to the earth, of the angle with which the sun rays enter, and all of these things which happen every 100,000 years, every 40,000 years, every 26,000 years. You have these different cycles which bring an ice age, a warming period, a small ice age, a warming period, and this is what's happening right now. And, you know, people should not waste this money at this conference here in Copenhagen in December. But, you know, if there is a climate conference, it should be on global cooling, you know. And I think you need, I think the citizens of Copenhagen should have a voice if they want to waste all of this money for this conference in the middle of this crisis. So if you want to talk about saving the planet, we should provide the countries of this world with the means to live. You know, people must eat, people must have food. You know, we have a shortage of food. We must double the food production, because already now, one-third of the human race is going hungry every day. Now, is that tolerable? I don't think it's tolerable. If you don't feel being upset about that, there's something wrong with you. No, I mean it, because it is exactly this. It's not just a financial crisis we are having. We are having a moral crisis, a crisis of indifferentism, a crisis of, you know, that people don't know the history of Europe anymore. I don't know how it is in Denmark, but in Germany, you know, you have entire generations who know absolutely nothing about the classical culture, who know nothing about science, who know very little about history. They Twitter, they Facebook, they do all kinds of things, but knowledge they don't have, you know. So I think we need a renaissance, and, you know, I think if we proceed with optimism, that it can be done, because there is something in human nature which reacts, that when you are confronted with a great crisis, something positive is coming up in your soul. And those of us who have not completely lost our souls, you know, we should be motivated to respond to this crisis by changing the world for the better.
So, thank you very much, Helga. A lot of food for thought. And we'll take some questions. I just want to say, if anybody, for whatever reason, have to be home early and leaves before we end the discussion, remember you can sign up out there to become a member. You can give a contribution. You can give your name and telephone number to make sure that you're in contact with us. And we also, 2 days from now, actually will show the webcast of LaRouche in our office, so you've got a notification. And then we also have our latest campaign newspaper out there that people can take and take a bundle home and distribute to friends, because I think there's no excuse for being ignorant, there's no excuse for letting your friends and neighbors be ignorant at this time. But else, I think, would like to open up for discussion, and I would ask anybody to ask before they ask a question, just to say who they are, and also if they are from some institution or whatever, then they can also say that.
Yeah? Because of John, when you come to the Skiller Institute in the basement, so we have heard he's not everything for a fact, I think, but a lot of it was not the name. That's fantastic, so to say. You don't need to come so many times in the Skiller Institute that you can follow the things.
Stimulus packages that's been mentioned and that's been passed through Congress. So, where did those figures come from? What does that really? Where does that figure come from?
Well, it is what I said. If you count all the different bailout packages from the period of August 2007. About half of it was public, but there was another part which, you know, they just pumped into the system. For example, there is, since a very long time, actually the latest since 1998, when the LTCM hedge fund was about to go under. That was about 4 billion capital, but with a leverage factor of about 100 billion. Now, that was when the Russian state bankruptcy occurred with the GKO crisis. As a consequence of that, the LTCM was about to go, and then the 16 largest banks of the world came together and bailed it out. And the Bank of International Settlement, in their annual report, wrote that this was about the meltdown of the system if they would not have done it. And ever since that time, you have something which in Wall Street, which is called the Plunge Protection Committee, which is a group of investment bankers who, every time when there is the danger of a systemic, what they call a systemic collapse, a big bank or a big insurer or something like that, they just pump money. You know, and that a lot of that is not reported.
So since 1998, and so is this money that's been given away or is it lent out by the reserve?
Well, it has been done differently in different countries. You know, in some cases they openly take over the banks, they take over the deposits. You know, like in England, they have practically nationalized all major banks. In other cases, the government gives guarantees. In other cases, you know, they, you know, it's slightly different, but the method is always the same, essentially, to honor the deposits 100%. Now, that happened in the case of AIG, for example. When they bailed out by AIG with 180 billion US dollars, then that money was given for losses of banks internationally which AIG had insured. And they gave 100% of the investment. Now, this alone should, you know, I mean, when you have firms going into bankruptcy procedure, you make a settlement. You know, you count what is the amount of money left, and then one gets 30%, the other one gets 40%. You make some kind of settlement. But nowhere do you pay somebody 100% when a firm gets into trouble. And that is part of the insanity, that they insist they want to be reimbursed for every toxic dollar they have. And that is just, you know, it's just not going to work. You have to write it off. Some people have, you know, just misspeculated. So what? If you take a high risk speculation, bad luck. You should have known ahead of time that that is a risky business. So it went wrong. Now take the losses, but do not honor and maintain this enormous amount of toxic waste.
Yeah. My name is Henrik. I'm a member of the field. I would like to hear two things. First, will this problem with the banks, which have almost, say, have all these toxic waste, again, you could say, will they not go down automatically? Because the bailout cannot be taken anymore because otherwise the government will get too much debt. Number one. Number two, sooner or later, the banks have to be that honest. One, two years, and say, okay, this money I lost, and then they will go bankrupt anyway. So the things will solve in another way instead of come from the box to put them under, say, on the bankruptcy. If they have to declare themselves bankrupt, and then this toxic waste will some kind of disappear, or what was going to happen? Number two is on your end point. I also say one of the main problems is that the younger people, I see very much the younger generation, my nieces and so on, they don't know anything. They spend their time in Facebook and Twitter, as you say. And it's been going on like that the last 20, 30 years, and then about the same like in Germany. How can we rebuild the young people with capacity for knowledge? It can take a whole generation. We have to simply change the pencil in the ground school, in the high school, in the gymnasium. It's a very long way to go.
Well, on the first question, the lie which they tell people is that, you know, if you do these bailout packages, then after 2 years or 5 years, you can sell these assets. But why should somebody buy it? Who should buy it? You know, it's a complete lie, because this is worthless paper. It's virtual. It does not exist. I always say it's very simple to solve that problem. Since it's virtual money, all you need to do is push the delete button in the computer and it's all gone. It does not exist. You know, and actually the only other person who says the same thing is Giulio Tremonti, the economic minister of Italy, who says, you know, people should not be freaked out about losing this because they never had it in the first place. It was only virtual. Yeah.
Those are the legal banks, the part of the 2 years, where they can't hide it anymore, because the government cannot help anymore. I mean, that America will be there in Europe, who should fill out anymore?
No, the point is the collapse of the real economy is what is systemic. And, you know, if they let that go down, like in the case of the auto sector right now, which is insane, you know, Fiat wants now to buy Opel, but the workers in Opel oppose it because they know that Fiat has no interest in saving German Opel places. They want to make a fusion, but then, you know, basically the present president of Fiat is saying it openly that then in a couple of years only 5 or 6 car producers worldwide would be left. Now, we say that this is crazy. You should reconvert, tell Opel to buy, to build only 1/3 cars, and reconvert the other industrial capacity to build tractors for Africa, land machines, maglev wagons, sluices, you know, all kinds of infrastructure can be built. If you have an engineer and you tell him, you know, you have to reconvert this, he will tell you, I need 8 months to do that, you know, and then he will do it. If you have, there are pictures from Porsche of the 50s building tractors. If they could reconvert from tractors to cars, why should they not be able to do it the other way? You know, and, you know, I mean, rather than being freaked out about the Chinese in Africa, which the Europeans are really freaked out about, well, the Chinese are making contracts with Africa. They get raw materials, but they build infrastructure. The most Africans are very happy with it because it's a fair deal. They don't call it development aid, they call it business. You give one thing and you get the other thing. And the European Union, they say, oh, democracy, human rights, you know, and it's crazy. We should tell Africa, we build all the infrastructure you want, and you give us raw materials, because Germany, for example, has no raw materials to speak of. So why should we not give them our engineering ability for what we need? That would be a fair thing. So it's all really totally crazy. Now, concerning the second question, well, you know, the LaRouche Youth Movement is exactly what should be done more broadly. Well, you know, Mr. LaRouche, about 8 or 9 years ago, realized that the young people in America at that time were a no-future generation. You know, because this was at the beginning of the Bush administration, so they closed down colleges, then told these young people, you like killer videos? Come to the army, have the real thing, you know. Go to Iraq, shoot in reality. You don't need video games for that. That's not a joke. This was a recruitment movie by the U.S. Army. So Mr. LaRouche at that point started to discuss this number of young people, and he designed a curriculum. How do you get young people who live in this environment, which is very difficult, how do you get them to be sure not to follow opinions, because some stupid economic institute says the recovery will come in 2010. Why should you believe it or not believe it? How do you know? How do you get a method of knowing things? How can you replicate the ability of forecasting of Mr. LaRouche, who happens to be absolutely on the mark? Well, so he designed a curriculum for science and for art where young people would rediscover the great discoveries in science, in art, in music, in poetry, and that way they would own it. You know, they would not take an opinion, but they would have reconstructed how did Eratosthenes, who was the head of the Library of Alexandria, how could he measure the circumference of the Earth by only a mistake of 50 kilometers, approximately 1500 before Christ. Now, at that time, nobody went with a spaceship and saw from a distance that the planet was was not flat, but it was a sphere. And you know, but he measured it, so he obviously had a conception, you know, by using a sundial and at noontime the difference in the shadow, and then going step by step, 1 meter each step, and he could measure it this way. Or how did Kepler discover gravitation? How did Bach discover polyphonic composition? I mean, these are all things one can study. And that's what the LaRouche youth movement is doing in the meantime in 5 continents. And that is the hope. Now, if we would be the government, how easy it would be, because we could even use TV for positive purposes. You know, I mean, you can use these medias, you know, you can use the internet for positive. We are doing it. If you go to the LaRouche PEC website, you see an increasing number of videos on scientific principles, on history, on, you know, artistic principles. And that was a response by Mr. LaRouche to the fact that, you know, most people do not read much anymore, especially young people. So if you like the Schiller Institute, help us to spread the videos, email them around to as many people as possible, you know, and just make sure that there is a growing network of people who are acquainted with these ideas. And if we would be the government, well, we would not have to have an order, but we would show master classes with great opera singers. People would get happy, you know, the joy of beautiful singing. I mean, here we have a couple of people who can attest to that. Ferida is one of them, Michelle, Christina. And when you learn to sing beautiful and you conquer one classical song after the other, it is a tremendous joy. And you could inspire young people by wanting to know science, by wanting to know painting, music, all of these things. The good thing is young people want to learn. And the problem is the school system is designed in such a way that it squashes creativity very, very early, you know, because it's rigid, it's too liberal, too anti-authoritarian, depending which place you are in, but it does not go for the cognitive. You know, if a state would be reasonable, they would say, I want to develop the creative potential of all of my citizens in the best possible way, because that's the best for the economy. they don't do that, shows that these governments are no good. So we need to change that, and hopefully as the crisis will get worse, more and more people will help us and mobilize, you know, because I cannot give you a guarantee that we win, but I can, you know, say the more people are helping, the better the chance is that we can use this crisis to get a change in a positive direction.
Yeah.
So good evening, everybody. My name is Alexander. I'm studying physics here in Copenhagen. And well, first, let's say thank you for the lecture. Concerning the financial ideas, to solve it, I agree. I'm not no expert on it. Mainly, what I do is reading what people I trust said about it. And already Thomas Jefferson warned about the financial system in the USA, and he was the president of the USA. But you also mentioned some other ideas of how to make a better world, yeah? Like bringing infrastructure to Africa. And I also agree on that, and very much I agree on that it's important that the people come back to old values, mainly from the period of enlightenment, yeah? Like Schiller or Kant. But I miss actually two points in your ideas of solving the world. And that's one thing is overpopulation, because I think we're just too many. We doubled since 1960 from 3 billion to 6 billion. And you cannot give so many people a proper education, because there are just not enough people to educate them. We even have a problem to educate, or let's say bring our young people on quality information and not just Facebook and whatever. And so that's the first point where I would like to hear what you think about the global population. And the second thing is that also the very basis for any successful society are certain freedoms and values. And right now in Europe, we have more and more political correctness. We have a shyness of dealing with Islam, not so much in Denmark, but a lot in other European countries. And one can see that the free speech already is limited quite a lot here. Not so much maybe in Denmark, but definitely in Great Britain and in Germany. And I mean, if you look in history, every time the freedom of speech was limited, it was the starting of a very bad time. So also in connection of what you think about the bigger influence of Islam in Europe, and also that there will be more and more people with this cultural background who maybe not only interested in MTV, but when they go back on other values, they go back to their roots. What is quite a contradiction to the values if you would like to have them, of the values of enlightenment, of all these freedoms?
Well, first of all, on the question of overpopulation, I think that's a Rockefeller baby. No, the reason why I'm saying that is there was in the 50s and the 60s the idea of development decades. In the United Nations, there was the idea that every 10 years a certain development goal would have been reached, and then you define the next goal for development so that eventually all countries would overcome underdevelopment. Now, that was a normal idea. As a matter of fact, in 1967, the Pope Paul VI wrote an encyclical, which was called Populorum Progressio, which was the idea that the injustice in the world was so crying for vengeance to the heavens that, you know, it had to be changed. And he said the new peace for peace, the new name for peace is development. And in that period, people thought that the population issue would be solved through development. You know, because if people have a normal education, if they have access to studies, also women, you know, that it would somehow normalize, that people would not have 10 children to have a pension in the, you know, when they are old, but you know that they would settle for lesser. And I think that that is a correct idea, because frankly no woman wants to have 15 children. I mean, it's just not desirable to it's bad for her health. It's you know, if you know how much work this is, you know. No, I mean, I know some people who have only 2 children who are already underneath it, you know. No, but the reason why I'm saying this Rockefeller baby is because we followed, as an organization, very, very closely the paradigm shift which went away from this idea of the new name of peace is development to overpopulation and limits to growth and, you know, all the ideas which that later became the ecology movement. As a matter of fact, I went in 1974 to the UN World Population Conference in Bucharest. And this was before this paradigm shift had occurred. And I presented there a paper about our perspective of development of the third world, which was infrastructure, real economic development. And there was a government conference, an NGO conference, and a media conference. And I intervened in the second 2 with this paper. And there was this meeting where John D. Rockefeller III was presiding, giving the keynote, and I had distributed my paper, put it on all the desks. So when he was finished speaking and the question and answer period started, he pointed to me, because I had a white blouse and a colorful hair band. I was young, and so he said, "Oh, this young lady there," and the person who sat beside him knew what was in my. "No, no, 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 not this one, not this one." But he said, "No, no, no, no." So I got the first question, and I said, "You know that unfortunately, what Rockefeller was proposing, which was sustainable development, it was, you know, all of these things which became later the key and code for no development." I said, if his policies would be implemented, then a lot of people would die as a result of it, and it would be genocide. And then pandemonium broke loose. You know, they totally, I mean, really closed down the conference, and then all the NGOs said I was right. Because at that point, all the left groups had not yet become green, but they were still pro-development, pro-third world. And at that point, everybody said, yeah, overpopulation, that's a Rockefeller baby, we know where it comes from. And that's why I spontaneously reacted this way. Because people knew that the large multinationals, this was in 74. 74 was the year where Henry Kissinger produced this unbelievable paper called NSM 200, which is this paper which was only published in the 90s, where he, as a national security advisor of Nixon, wrote this paper that all raw materials of the world are the strategic interest of the United States, and that therefore the U.S. should discourage population growth, especially in those countries which have a lot of raw materials, because too many people eat too many raw materials. And then the paper ended with the argument that, you know, that in order to enforce that policy, it was even allowed to use the food weapon. However, one should be careful not that this would not look too imperialistic, therefore one should cover it a little bit and make more polite words, but that was the message. And that is the bottom line of the British Empire. That is why they have been pushing population explosion as a concept, why this, you know, in some sense all of these things have been really orchestrated, because, you know, if you develop, go to India, there you can see it in the best way. You have an upper class of Indians who are living of a living standard like Europe, about 350 million people. The women there have 1 child, 2 children, maximum 3, and that's normal because they want to have their education, they want to have university studies, and they don't want to have or these children, because you cannot have both. You cannot have 15 children and study. It's impossible. So therefore, the answer is not population control and forced sterilization like they did in Brazil at a certain point, but it is development. Give the women a chance to develop their mind as equal human beings, and then this problem will be solved. And, you know, right now there is no overpopulation, maybe in Belgium. Because Belgium has a square kilometer per capita ratio, which, you know, they are border case. But Africa is underpopulated. Africa is completely underpopulated. If you look the per capita ratio to square kilometer, and naturally the average age, life expectancy, you see that you need to have a lot more people in Africa before you can reach the level of an advanced industrial agricultural continent. You know, I think people have been a lot brainwashed. Then think, you know, my husband and I were a couple of years ago invited in Dubai to address a conference of the question of oil in the 21st century. And my husband made a beautiful animation by taking the last 20,000 years of our time and squeezed it into 5 minutes. So the last 20,000 years was when the last ice age ended, and you had a sea level much lower than now, about 40 meters lower. And you had the Sahara green, the Iraq green, you know, everything was completely green. And then if you condense these 20,000 years into 5 minutes, you see how the process of desertification is going forward, you know. Then you find these beautiful Felszeichnungen, rock paintings in caves in the middle of the Sahara, where you see giraffes eating figs. You know, now I do not think that a couple of thousand years ago people went into the Sahara desert painting giraffes on the wall with figs. I think there were giraffes eating figs, and then people painted them, you know. So therefore, you know, if you have now cheap, inherently safe nuclear energy, like the high-temperature reactor, the pebble bed reactor, and you put a lot of small reactors on the coast, and you produce a lot of fresh water in the Middle East, in the Gulf, in Africa, then, you know, you can reconquer arable land, which right now is not habitable, and make beautiful gardens. You can make, you know, oases. I once flew from Amman to Khartoum to Amman, a 3.5-hour flight. And it's desert, desert, desert. Not one green place, not one little oasis, nothing. Now, if you would, and the lack of water in that region is, in any case, the biggest danger to peace. Now, if you make new water by desalinization, you eliminate the cause of war, you regain new areas for people to live on, and you can just make the world more habitable. Or take what the Russians want to do with the Far East of Russia. This is a region, it's huge, and it has the largest raw material reserves of the planet. It has every raw material which is in the Mendeleev table, every single one you find there, but you cannot just go there and unearth it, because it's Arctic and it's you know, permafrost conditions. So you need to do something to develop this region, you know, in order to make it habitable. And that there are many, many things which we haven't done yet in order to make this world a better place. And then after that, we should go to space. You know, seriously, to the moon, to the Mars, and then explore how the universe looks like. We are just at the beginning of development. I think mankind is in its baby embryo condition, maybe a couple of days around. We are not at the limit of the potential of what mankind can be. It's just that people have lost the power of imagination. They are no longer thinking about, you know, pioneering new fields of knowledge. They say, oh, we know everything already. You know, they are crippled, you know. It's, you mentioned Schiller. You know, Schiller at his time, which was 200 years ago, said the biggest problem of his time was the lack of Empfindungsvermögen. The biggest problem was the lack of sensuous grasp for other people or other the world. You know,
compassion.
Yeah, compassion. The lack of compassion. The lack of imagination and compassion combined. And you know, if you look at what happens to the youth today, you know, with the Winnenden massacre or all these, my husband was talking about, you know, all these shootings which go on, you know, where people are completely dehumanized. I mean, you have a hard time of even understanding why this is occurring, because it doesn't make sense, you know. It's just a collapse of civilization, and it's a collapse of perspective. And I think we need to inspire people again. We need to tell people there is a reason to learn. If you are a young person and you look at a world where everything is done already, and you know all you can do is fight for one of the few jobs with a perspective that you study and then you be unemployed at the end, that's not a very intriguing idea. But if you are passionate because you want to overcome poverty, you want to overcome, you know, you want to overcome the condition in which people are, because you love people too much that you can stand it that they are in the present state. That's how you should feel. You know, when you see other people, young people around you, who are almost autistic because they only can play video games or you know, play certain Facebook social networking. This is the most idiotic thing. You have no friends when you have Twitter friends. I mean, this is absurd. People are becoming autistic. I have seen young people who are completely unable of any social response because they are hooked to this virtual stuff. And you have to learn poetry. You have to love to... Denmark is the great ally and friend of Schiller. Schiller, you know, would not have probably survived his sickness, but for this Prince...
Frederik Christian of Augustenburg.
Right. No, but that's a proud tradition, so you can reconnect and make a Schiller Renaissance. You have the 250th birthday of Friedrich Schiller this year. So you should make in Copenhagen a big Schiller fest, and all of you should contribute. You should learn Die Glocke. It's only 27 minutes long.
My name is Pierre Schwartz. I have a question in simple terms. If you could tell us as to what you meant with hyperinflation, as to when it will happen, if you can give not a schedule, but estimate as to what will happen, when that will happen, one, two, what will then consequently happen to the dollar, US dollar, of course.
Mm.
And possibly also, you haven't mentioned euro that much, but also if you could include in simple terms as to what it would mean to the euro in Europe.
The euro.
Thank you. Yeah. Euro, euro, whatever. Thank you.
Well, I think the danger of a hyperinflationary explosion could be triggered by a whole bunch of events, but essentially by a slowing down of the economy, because eventually you have the problem of this accumulated liquidity and, you know, the collapsed real economy. And then eventually, you know, the dollar will collapse and you will have a disorderly collapse. Now the hyperinflation is essentially the point when the, you know, this process can no longer be hidden. When you have a depressed physical economy, and this money somehow has to be realized, and that could happen this year. You could see the beginning of a serious inflation this year, because this whole talk about by the central banks that it doesn't matter if you put all this liquidity in, because after the economy has jumped on again, that the central banks can somehow take the money out, that has never happened, and it will never happen. I think you need a complete change. You need what I said. You cannot. The problem is not in the field of monetary questions alone. You have to restart the physical economy. And to do that, you have to throw out of the window all the axiomatic stuff which goes along with globalization. Cheap labor, out. Just-in-time production, out. You know, the whole idea of benchmarking, that you do not make experiments anymore, but you make computer models. You have to go back to physical economy. You have to have people who study what is production, what is actually the scientific input into a discovery, you know, which leads to a progress in the knowledge of man over nature. And right now, when you have literally generations of people who have studied nothing of that. If you study Volkswirtschaft, what is Volkswirtschaft?
National economy.
National economy, you study how to speculate on the futures market, how to be competitive in the market. You study only categories of the free trade system. You do not study Kepler, you do not study Leibniz, you do not study Liszt, you do not study Carey, you do not study any of the great economists who were the contributors of the Industrial Revolution. For example, in Germany, nobody knows that the Bismarck reforms, which turned Germany from a feudal country to an industrial country, were based on the ideas of Henry Carey, because the head of the German Industry Association became a follower of Carey, and he advised Bismarck. You read all the biographies of Bismarck, and you do not find one reference in it. So it could happen very quickly. Now, the euro, I'm convinced, will not survive. It will not survive. It cannot. Because the discrepancies between the so-called Nachhol countries, the newer countries, and the other countries, it's just not functioning. Right now, there will come a point where the German taxpayers will say no. Because there will come a point where the German taxpayer will realize that we do not have the money to pay our own health system, that you have increasingly euthanasia, because if you are over a certain age and have a stroke and you are in the hospital, you don't get certain reha treatments. You know, this is already happening now, even before the thing gets really out of control. And then you should pay for banks having miscalculated in Hungary, in Austria, pay for Greece, pay for Portugal. It will come to a limit. I'm absolutely certain of it. And the dollar, if the reforms which we are proposing are not implemented, or if such crazy schemes like replacing the dollar with special drawing rights, if that ever would become a serious proposition, and you would have a collapse of the dollar, the whole world system would go with it right there. And that is very close. So, you know, the best thing you can do, help come to force the German, the Danish parliament and other institutions that they seriously think about this. And if the big changes are coming, they should attach themselves to it, and there should be an educated citizenry you know, in Denmark who know what these issues are. So spread the word, you know, look at the webcast of my husband, either in the archive, come to the office, because I'm sure he will talk about that at great length.
What makes you think that China can't survive the crash of the dollar?
They cannot.
But they have the industrial capacity they still have the same factories, they still have the same industry. So what makes them so dependent on the dollar?
Well, the Chinese, I had the fortune to be in China in 71. That was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution. And that was one of the experiences of my life, which, you know, you have like 3-4 things you, when you are lucky, which you experience early on, and they shape your life. You know, if you experience them, it goes this way, if not, it goes that way. And that trip, for me, was one of the most important experiences because I saw a lot of things, but in China I saw the Red Guards painting red, all the cultural goods, and I saw the misery. I mean, as a matter of fact, you know, in Copenhagen you have now almost as many bicycles as you had in China in 71. It's an amazing phenomenon. But you had no cars then, you know, in Beijing. And then I went back to China exactly after 25 years with the idea of the Eurasian Land Bridge, and I was a speaker at one of the at a big conference in Beijing. And there you had seen this incredible development in the East Coast and in the South. And at that point, you know, one of the things I was saying in many speeches in, you know, in institutions that they should not orient towards the export of cheap products to the United States, but they should redirect their resources and develop the inner regions. And they did not do that. If you go to China today, you have 30% of the people are very developed, very rich. You have the funniest phenomena of communist billionaires, but we have 70% of the population who are still living in the Stone Age, who are literally plowing the earth with a stick. They don't have cows, they don't have other machinery, so they are still very poor. And there is a big crisis right now because already now about 20 million or more of so-called migrant workers from the industrial areas have lost their jobs and they have gone back to the countryside and they are not sending the wages there, so it's already a big explosion. And, you know, I mean, I like China a lot, but I also know that the Chinese government will not be soft on social unrest. They will not. So it's a very big crisis, and, you know, they cannot easily, you know, they have accepted cheap labor production, which was a big mistake. Even if it brought a certain amount of development to a part, it is not enough to, a price must be fixed in such a way that it pays not only for the labor, but for the family, for the children, for the grandparents, and Walmart in such a, people, they have paid a price, yeah, just low price. Cheap labor production is called cheap labor production because it's cheap, you know. And they have a big crisis. The best thing the Chinese government at this point could do would be to, as quickly as possible, redivert towards the development of the inner region, which is the land bridge idea. You know, to build roads, to build maglev, to build, you know, other corridor infrastructure. And I think they're having a big crisis. The Chinese right now are in a big, big, big crisis. don't believe what they say, because the Russians also, they say a lot of things because they already have social unrest, and they don't want to fuel it by you see the freak out in Germany when Gesine Schwan, who is the presidential candidate of the social democracy, she warned of social unrest. Ooh, there was a freak out, unbelievable, basically saying, you are causing it, you know, by talking about it. I mean, she doesn't address the reasons either. She doesn't propose what to do differently to prevent it from happening.
Michelle?
Yeah. We're celebrating the 250th anniversary of the birth of Friedrich Schiller, and you referred to Schiller just before, but could you go more into depth about what Schiller can, how Schiller can speak to people now in 2009, and also to people who are approaching dealing with these type of crises?
Well, first of all, the reason why I gave the name Schiller Institute to the Schiller Institute is because I think his image of man is just the most beautiful. Because he has this idea that every man should have a beautiful soul. Now, I think this is an eminently good idea. You know, people think about their beautiful body, they go to the fitness studio, but if they would spend the same effort on getting their soul beautiful, you know, it would be so much better for them. And a beautiful soul, Schiller defines as somebody who does passionately what is necessary. You're not a Kantian, you're not going, I have to do my duty, but you do it because you have to do it. You are the good Samaritan who is just responding to, you know, what is required. And Schiller has this idea of the sublime. I mean, this is also a very important idea, because, you know, if you remember Amelia Boynton Robinson, she's always talking about fear, that fear turns people into slaves. Because if you are fearful, then, you know, you submit, or you don't dare to think certain things. And Schiller has this idea of the sublime, which is the idea that naturally, as physical human beings, we are weak. Every lion is stronger, every bear is, you know, more powerful, every ox can pull more weight, you know, all these animals have much more powers, but as physical beings, we are not very impressive. Therefore, Schiller says we have to attach our identity to values which are beyond our mortal life, to universal ideas. And that way you do not become physically safe, but you become morally safe. And I think this is a very important idea, especially in this time, that, you know, if you cherish the idea of freedom, which Schiller does, I mean, he was called the poet of freedom, you know, then you are internally free. And you are internally, once you have reached that condition that you are internally free, you can deal with everything. You know, and that comes from, you know, developing your emotions. Schiller was very explicit that you can, through aesthetical education, you not only can develop your mind, many people think, yeah, I have to study, I have to develop my mind, but for many people, actually most of them, the mind is not even the problem, even if there is a lot of problems many times. But for most people, it is the emotions which are crippled. You know, and that is what Schiller is really the best for, because he gives you a way of developing passion, compassion, love, insight. He's the best psychologist I know. And it's just the beautiful image of man, and his poetry is just very lofty and ennobling. You know, I think people need poetry. A day without poetry is dull, you know, because you have to think, you have to train the quality in your mind which enables you to think metaphor. Because a poem is a poem because it's not prose. If the poet would just write prose, then that would be a different matter. But the meaning of a poem is a higher one than in the prose. And for the mind to be able to think that is training a faculty in you which makes you human, because it is the creative faculty. So there are many good reasons to, you know, to study Schiller, and, you know, to, I mean, for me, there are a couple of thinkers where I always go back to, and when I have a problem, they fix my world. One of them is Schiller, the other one is Lindlerhusch. No, also Leibniz and Kusa and so forth. But there are a couple of people who are just coherent, you know. Not many people are coherent. Most people have minds like minestrone. You have a radish and a potato and a carrot, and it all doesn't fit together.
May I just add to that point? I'm Paul Kemper, and I'm new here. I did not even know about the institution's existence until about a week ago. But I happened to read about you, and also I came to read about it because my interest was in the strange celebration that took place in the northern part of this island, where Baxton, the Danish writer, gathered with some people to celebrate what they believed to be the death of Schiller. Fortunately, it was not, but they had the celebration. And I work for what's in Denmark called Fox University, that's the Fox University. And our intention is to make a celebration this fall on the very place where that celebration took place in 1791. And I contacted the Schiller Institute, and they were very open for discussion and readily agreed to take part in what I hope would be something very interesting. Now, when I came here, I felt that it should mainly be on what the Danes did, but now learning more about Schiller and certainly listening to your fabulous lecture, I think we should focus more on Schiller than on Baggison and on what took place. And that would be a fine way to a Danish audience that is very accustomed to Schiller, because Schiller is being played again and again on dates in Denmark, which I'm quite sure you know, but Schiller is there and on people's mind. So that would be a wonderful occasion to celebrate that this fall, and hopefully we can do that together with the Schiller Institute here. So hopefully some of you might like to take part as well. Now, it's in the beginning of the planning, but certainly because of what I heard tonight, I will certainly push on with planning, and hopefully we can do something. But thank you.
Yes.
Very good.
It's getting, huh?
It's getting late.
It's getting late.
There was another.
There was another question.
Huh? What?
Okay.
Oh, I have a question about a bit of a follow-up on what we developed about Schiller, and also this idea of the cultural renaissance for particularly young people. And my question is, what is you are a known scholar of Kusa. I'd like to know what is the impact of the thought of Kusa on what became the Italian Renaissance. I don't know how to structure the question properly, but it should be how these ideas, maybe where they came from, and how they proliferated into the Italian society that created this dynamic.
Well, there are many, many aspects, but in general, it was really recognized that Kusa was a towering giant of his time. People had a perception, you know, I mean, like, it's the same with Lin, you know, people who get to know Lin, they immediately know he's a genius, they immediately recognize that there is a higher order of mind working, and that was the case with Kusa. I think the fact that he contributed to the Council of Florence in the way he did even if he did not participate personally in it because he was relatively too young, but he had gone to Byzantium on behalf of Piccolomini and found the original handwritings which proved that the early councils of the church had the filioque, you know, that the this was the big theological issue between the Orthodox Church and the Roman Church, and he could find that in the Council of Nicaea and other early councils, they had the filioque, that the Logos emanates from the Father and the Son, filioque. And that led then to the unification of the Roman and the Orthodox Church, and he brought the entire Greek delegation to that council with him on the ship, and there they all brought the collected works of Plato. And that was really what triggered this whole thing, because people recognized that they had to go back to the high point of the Greek classic, and that really, I mean, there were many other elements going into the Italian Renaissance, like the heritage of Dante, of Petrarca, but it was this matching with this Plato which really exploded this. And naturally, Nicholas of Cusa, he was very aware that he was, he actually talked about a new epoch in the Dr. Ignorantia, in the introduction. He says, I'm aware that I'm the beginning of a new epoch. That's what Lynn always says. You know, when you are a thinker who thinks things which have not been thought before, you know, you are pretty lonely because you realize you are the first one and, you know, what do you do? So Nicholas had no shame to talk about himself in this way. And it was really, if you read the different writings, the method of the coincidentia oppositorum, Nicholas said nobody thought about that before. And it's really true, you know, because it's thinking the one of a higher quality than the many. You know, and it's that's why I'm saying the Peace of Westphalia conception comes from that thinking, because you have to be able to think the solution of the conflict on a higher level, and then you can go into the, you know, differentiation. But if you never get above the difference, like Aristotle, you know, then you never have peace. You always have contradiction. And, you know, then you end up at Maoism, who says that every development comes from the contradiction, which is really an Aristotelian concept. So Nicholas was really the one who overcame all of that. He founded the modern reciprocal representative system, you know, in the Concordantia Catholica. That was the crucial conception which laid the foundation for the modern sovereign nations. And it's definitely worth, I mean, please not only read Schiller, also read Nicholas.
It's getting late, so I think we will have to end the discussion. It's become totally clear that, of course, we have to invite Helga up here again and give at least a full presentation on Schiller. And that, of course, has to be in this Schiller year. We have the 250 years celebration of the birth of Schiller. And then throw in a couple of presentations on Cusa and different other things. I think it's been very beautiful of you to come here and also to really be a source of joy and optimism. Now, what is so special about the Schiller Institute is that this is not about following the world and looking at all of these things going on and being a commentator of the world. And there's a lot of commentator on the world economic crisis. They have a comment. What we very uniquely represent, and what LaRouche represents, and Helga and the whole movement, is that you're not a commentator on history, but you instead decide to be a historical individual which intervenes into history. And since so few persons choose to become historical individuals and intervene into history, if you decide to do so, you will succeed in shaping a lot of history. So I will again ask everybody to join, join as a member, join as an activist, contribute. We need to print a new campaign newspaper now. Give your telephone number. Come, as I said, LaRouche has a webcast tonight, which unfortunately got arranged after we arranged our meeting. It can be viewed on the internet, but you can also come on Thursday to our office and see it there and discuss all of these things much further. And you can take a bundle of newspaper out there and help distribute and help to spread our ideas. So please be active. If you give your phone number, we also have regular meetings. We report them, we also record them and put them on the internet for those who cannot be present. So there's a lot of possibilities of doing things. But lastly, I would ask you all to thank Helga for being here. And yeah.
And was a good friend of Chris Bama, and he also traveled his tours in South Africa, so he's very connected to the questions in Africa.
Very, very good. There have been people
here. I found Jens Büstow. He's a doctor who actually commutes to and from Africa. He is a consultant about health issues in Africa.
Well, we're trying to challenge the development agendas.
Good. And you say he's been supporting our campaign for many years and a supporter of